So mainly we would look at karma from the point of view of the Pali Canon, which is the early teachings of Buddha that all schools of Buddha, Dharma, uphold as the authentic teachings of the Buddha. Now, modern scholars would say the Pali Canon, probably some of it wasn't the words of the Buddha. Maybe none of it was the actual exact words of the Buddha. There's different sections that they think are older than others. But still, this is what we have to go on, is it's a whole systematic presentation of the Buddha's basic teachings on how these things work. And as a whole, there's maybe some internal contradiction within them, but it's a pretty good working whole. It seems like it doesn't contradict itself so much, the Pali Canon, the teachings of Theravada Buddhism, and the Mahayana generally agrees that these are, even though there's more elaborate teachings and derivations of these, they all say, well, these are the basic root teachings. So there's quite a few sutras where the Buddha talks about karma and rebirth. But starting with karma, this on this handout, you can look at this. This first one introduces these different aspects of karma in a really clear and way. And a lot of this is quite straightforward, but let's go through it. So karma, literally the word karma, or in Pali, kama is the way of saying it, literally means action. You could say intentional action, but the action of living beings, activity or deeds, those would be the translations, usually translated as action. And so karma should be known. The condition by which karma comes into play should be known. The diversity in karma should be known. The result of karma should be known. The cessation of karma should be known. And the path of practice for the cessation of karma should be known. So these are these topics that now he's going to, just in this short section of this one sutra, talk about these different dimensions of action. So first of all, intention, which is this other Pali or Sanskrit word, chetana, which means intention, volition, or will. Intention, I tell you, is karma. Intending was one does karma by way of body, speech, and mind. So this is, I would say, the most important sentence that really defines karma. And it's often quoted in, what is karma? The Buddha himself says here, defining, what is this action? Action actually is volition, or intention, or will.
So this is a bit different than, say, reaction. Let's say my intentional will as opposed to I hit my knee and there's a reaction in my knee. So this is not intentional.
Exactly, yeah. And breathing is not it's an activity of a person. Of a sentient being breathes, and like the heartbeat, what do you call it when the doctor knocks your knee, and the reflex actions are actions, but they're not karmic actions. So that's why if we put these two together, we could say intentional actions of body, speech, and mind, meaning there's some will or volition or intention behind it.
And then when you bring up the idea of will, your self-will in the sense of you think that you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what is will or volition? I think we could say that it's does it involve, I mean, that's a question that the Buddha never defines exactly, but does it involve a view of a self acting? And some people say, I've heard it said, that it does mean that actually it's intentional action from the point of view of an independent doer, mm-hmm. like a self that does things, mm-hmm. from the point of view of a sentient being who believes on some deep level or comes from the the view that I do things.
Mm-hmm.
That would be intentional action. So for a Buddha, say, who doesn't hold that view and actually just sees their whole experience as merely just dependent arising with no independent doer, that actually their action is not karmic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so clear in these sutras whether that's the case or not for, like, the Buddha who's giving them, whether he, I don't know if he ever says, I do, you know, karma, or this, the Tathagata, you know, has karma, does karmic activity. Because also I think maybe most accurately we'd say no, because the Buddha does talk about the cessation of karma, like when there's no longer this intentional action like this. And I would understand that to be that when there's no more view of the independent doer, there's still dependent co-arising of a human being living in the world, but there's the deep understanding and experiential understanding that everything is just arising from conditions, and it's not from the point of view of a self. But it does look like a Buddha, someone without the view of an independent self, still has what we call intention. And this chetana, I mean, it's defined as one of the five universal factors of any mind moment. Any mental experience includes, or what we call mind, any moment of mind includes these universal factors, one of which is intention. And the others are like feeling. There's like, could be very subtle, neutral kind of feeling. But all mental moments include intention, feeling, and perception. Could be very subtle. This would include even, I think even like sleep states where we're still alive and all the senses are kind of shut off temporarily. And there's almost no mental activity, but there'd be these very subtle forms of perception going on, even at that time. And intention. And it might be in a kind of dormant phase, but something like that. Yeah.
So this chetana, from what you've just said, doesn't necessarily entail an object.
It doesn't entail an object. Yeah, I think we could have, my understanding that we could be like in non-dual meditation, for example, where there's just non-dual awareness, and it wouldn't, but without, there would still be intention, a very subtle form of, at that point, another way of talking about intention is like the shape of the mind. That's how some people describe it. It's like the overall pattern of the mind. So it's not a very active, it's not like, there might not be the thought of, keep concentrating here so I can stay in this state. Like that would be a kind of dualistic mind. But in a non-dual aware mind, there's still a pattern of overall mind. And that's how a very subtle chetana would be operating at that time.
So a pure form of chetana would be, say, beginner's mind.
Would be what?
Beginner's mind.
Well, yeah, depending on how we define that. Yeah, just kind of like openness, maybe. Openness, readiness.
Readiness, but but readiness to all things happening. So it entails a certain movement outward.
Yeah. Or it includes the world.
Yeah.
As you can see, even as we start to get into these, it's hard to define very precisely. But it's a little bit, you know, this is how the Buddha is defining, basically, but it does bring up all these questions.
Yeah. And I raise this because in our popular language, we talk about having good intentions, bad intentions, and always an object for it.
I think often it includes that. And I think Buddha's bringing up this whole teaching of karma because he's talking on this more everyday level, I think, actually. And we could get into the questions of how does it operate in these non-dual minds and so on. But really, he's talking about this very basic everyday level where it is like that. it does imply an object, usually. That's our usual everyday experience. So intention is karma. Or chetana is karma, or intention is action. Intending, one does action by way of body, speech, and mind. And what is the condition by which karma comes into play? Contact is the cause by which karma comes into play. So that goes back to that point of contact between a mind and an object, or a sense organ and a sense object. That's but particularly mind and mental objects, like when we're just, you know, engaging with the world, that contact of me and the world is the condition for intention to arise.
So when we speak of the mind as a sixth sense, its contact is chetana.
No, contact is a condition for chetana.
Okay.
Yeah, the condition by which it comes into play. So the first thing is the defining it. He's going through this exposition of karma. The first one is, it should be known, and it should be known as intention, and then the condition should be known. The condition for intention and karma is contact. The diversity in karma should be known. That's the different types. So that's the karma to be experienced in these five or six realms. So hell, the karma experience in the realm of animals, in the realm of hungry ghosts, human world, and heavenly worlds. That's the diversity of action. So already now we're talking about action means the intentional activity from that first moment of intention, and it also implies the fruit, the karmic, the fruit of the action, the result of the action is also called karma. And I think in popular American language, it's taken on that meaning, which is not the primary meaning, and it's kind of get kind of distorted. In our culture, we say, that person, ended up with that job or something. Like, oh, that was just their karma. We use it very loosely like that. That was their karma. And it's, you know, it's somewhat related to the Buddha's meaning, but it's a little off. It's more like their intentions were factors in them getting that job, and the results of their intentions landed them in such a job. But it's still, I think it's a little off to say, like, that's their karma. It's more like that's a fruit of a result of their karma and a result of a bunch of other conditions, too. It's not that karma is the only conditioning factors of our experience of life. Although it sometimes gets stretched almost to that point in some teachings, that karma actually is the... Everything is created by karma, but we'll get into that. So this is talking about the result of intention is experienced in these five realms. In the early teachings, I think they don't have six. They don't talk about the fighting spirits, the asuras. Maybe occasionally in the Pali Canon, but often there's these five realms. And then there's, you know, people argue, are these literal places? And they're described in the sutras, you know, the hot hells and the cold hells and the different heaven realms all defined. Or are they metaphors for our experience? And you could take it either way. But I think if the literal meaning seems too far out, to take it as metaphor, I think works, because everybody experiences what we might call hell realms, hellish states, and which are like caused by the karma or intention of anger or hatred. Usually is the result is hell, the most painful realm. And animal realm is kind of blind desire creates, and the hungry ghosts are by like also desire, dissatisfaction. And the human realm is kind of this balanced realm where we're generally living, that's, you know, not as high as these heavenly realms, which are like everything's going very well. But so there's in Buddhism there's heavens and hells, but they're not eternal. They're created by karma and intention, and they're temporary, and they last as long as the karmic intention that creates the result of that state lasts a certain amount of time. And, you know, to try to map these things, the Buddha also says there are something like five things that can make a person crazy. And one of them is trying to figure out how karma, you know, works, or how karma cause and effect could, like, actually land. Like, if this action will produce this result, if you try to map it like that, he's like, it'll make you crazy. You can't do it. Yeah. And yet, so it's not linear. It's not like this action produces this result always. Because we're talking about dependent co-arising, which I think most people have probably heard this term, that, you know, everything arises dependent on many, many conditions. Sometimes we could even say everything in the universe is conditioning every moment of experience. And karma is one of the conditions. But it's, so that's why there's a sutra that I didn't include here that says somebody's asking the Buddha, like, does this action always produce, or maybe he's asking, does sickness just come from karma of that person? And the Buddha says, no, actually. I think this is an interesting one, that the Buddha says, no. Don't you know about, you know, bile disorders and wind disorders? And he goes into all this, you know, Indian medicine terms, like physical bodily medicine, right? It's like, so karma is a factor, but there's also bile disorders that aren't necessarily caused by intentional action. They're just like, there's other conditions. Like, you go into a polluted area and you start coughing. You say, oh, this cough must be caused by karma. And, no, there's stuff in the sky that's making us cough too. Again, though, we could open this up more if we're really studying karma carefully and say, well, actually, the pollution in the sky was caused by karma. And the fact that I'm in this polluted city is due to, you know, my own intentions and so on. So you could, to expand karma in this largest way, that actually everything is created in this almost inconceivable way by all things. And it involves not just this person, but many people. And they talk about sometimes collective karma, like air pollution is a result of intentional actions of human beings, obviously, right? But it's not one human being. So that, and they would sometimes call that a collective karmic result. So that's part of the complexity. The Buddha is mainly talking about individual people and studying themselves and their own experience, because that's what the practice mostly is. But that also all of this stuff is interdependent with other people and their intentions and so on, in this incredibly complex, woven, interdependent way. So what is the result of karma? Is the next thing he answers. The result of karma is three sorts, I tell you. That which arises here and now, that which arises later, and that which arises following that. And I don't know about the translations exactly, but usually this is understood as, and I think maybe even translated, maybe this translator was trying to make it really broad and not talk about future lives. But it's usually translated as karma in the three times, is in this life, in the next life, or in subsequent future lives. So karma, the karmic fruition, karmic results happen in this life, or the next life, or future lives down the road. And Dogen Zenji, our Zen founder, has a Shobogenzo essay called Karma in the Three Times. And again, near the end of his life, and he defines them in this way, in theory. The result appearing in this life, the next life, or future lives. Just right out of these early sutras, really. And one of the reasons they say that, just to jump ahead a little bit, I think it's in one of these other sutras, but the point about saying that it can ripen, the fruition of intentions can come in a future life, is because people start questioning. They say, well, this person does all this bad stuff, negative actions, right, harmful actions in this life, but their life's going very well, and it seems like they're not they don't have any bad effects of this. Look, they die really happy, even though they did all this bad. So that disproves karma, right? And so that's one way to that the Buddha would say, well, no, actually, it's coming. It's all coming around. These results will come, but not in this life. And they also, vice versa, to explain, this person, why was this baby born with, you know, crippled from birth or something like this? That seems so, like, it doesn't make any sense. And one explanation would be, well, it's this is all just this long process, and there was some intentions in previous lives that created this effect in this life. Or if it doesn't happen in that, then in the future. And this is where it can start to get controversial in the discussion.
Yeah, the rebirth.
Yeah, that's already talking about rebirth. But I think let's keep going a little bit ahead into karma and come back to this point about three lives and fruition across lives, if we can. I think it'd be nice, like, really clarify how karma works first, and then rebirth is a more complicated topic. If we look at all the different aspects of karma, then we can get into that. So basically, what's the result? So then the next question, what's the cessation of karma? From the cessation of contact is the cessation of karma. So because, remember, the condition for karma is contact. So if the condition ceases, then the result ceases. That's also how the kind of mechanism of the Four Noble Truths. If there's the cause and the effect, and if you take away the cause or the condition, then the effect ceases. So that's a kind of a strange, cryptic kind of saying in itself, which I think to keep going through this, I don't think it's that important right now to get into what that means. But this next point of this Eightfold Path, right, the classic path of practice, right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, that is the path of practice leading to the cessation of karma. And I think the interesting point here is that the Eightfold Path is karma. It's like, in fact, right action literally is karma, or I think it's karmanta, but virtually the same word. And other thing, you know, right speech, and right speech, right conduct, and right intention or resolve, those are the three karmas, three body, speech, and mind action, right? So and then meditation also, and mindfulness are karmic, intentional practices, and livelihood is intentional, and effort is intentional. So the whole Eightfold Path is karma, wholesome karma, good karma. And so good karma is the path to ending karma, is another way to look at this. That good intentions, wholesome intentions, which is going to be defined later, what good and or wholesome and unwholesome are. But that wholesome actions are the path to ending karma. And later the Buddha will say the ending of suffering, when there's the ending of karma, there's the ending of suffering. So he completely connects the, you know, the Four Noble Truths, like the cessation of suffering with the cessation of this intentional activity. So this is where it gets kind of subtle also. What is the cessation of karma? But to keep moving through the more basic parts here, we can come back to these. When a disciple of the Noble Ones, of the Buddhas, discerns karma in this way, the condition by which karma comes into play, all these things that he just said, then he discerns this penetrative holy life as the cessation of karma. So when understanding how all this works, then there's the actual cessation of karma. And does this mean the cessation of just negative karma or all karma? And I think he's pointing to, in the end, any action that comes from an independent doer, and then the Buddha's activity at this, when there's the cessation of karma, is just response to the world, compassionate response, dependently arisen, compassionate response depending on the conditions of the suffering of all beings in the world.
Sort of like creating the environment where the conditions, beginning to create the conditions that generally create wholesome conditions for one.
Mm-hmm.
For creating the environment where
where it can all drop away.
Unwholesome activity is less likely to arise.
Mm-hmm. That would be part of karma, and the Eightfold Path is creating that environment. Eightfold Path is creating that environment and acting in that environment in a wholesome way, and right view in particular. And right view, we could say, is maybe not karmic. It's not an intention. It's actually a view. It's an understanding or a view based on wholesome karma of the, you know, ultimately of the cessation of karma. Right view.
Mm-hmm. The cessation of karma be associated with the merging of difference and unity.
How so?
With the merging of difference and unity, there is no there's no chain. There's no this and that. This plus that. Plus that.
Mm-hmm.
The merging of difference and unity would be possibly a cessation of karma. There's no intention in that.
Mm-hmm.
So when we read that sutta, the merging of difference and unity, and we hear don't waste time, don't make up standards on your own, this kind of thing, they're basically saying those are contrary forces in your intention. So withdraw from that and come to this place where you're just present. And so I would think, logically, that when we talk about the cessation of karma, the cessation of the condition of karma, which is the cessation of intention, would have to entail that moment of the merging of difference and unity.
Maybe we could talk about it that way, or just completely surrendering to the present.
Yeah.
And or as Dogen says, you know, to carry the self forward and experience myriad things is delusion, but the myriad things coming forth and experiencing the self or themselves is awakening. So at that point, it's like almost seems unintentional. There's just the myriad things coming forth, creating this being that's moving through the world and doing things, but it's not that the person's carrying themselves forward and doing them, but the myriad things are carrying the person forward and enabling good, compassionate responses to all beings in the world in this very natural way, without effort even, in the end. So the moving down to this next sutra, there are these causes for the origination of actions, and we heard that, you know, contact is a cause or a condition, but this is more common way of putting it too, because there's more than one condition for everything. But this is the common one. Greed, hate, and delusion, right, are the origin or the condition for intention. Or intentional action come from greed, hate, and delusion. So that's why, you know, in our chant, we say, all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. It comes from that. Born through body, speech, and mind, which is defined here, I now fully avow. So it's a nice summary of these early teachings on karma in that verse that we chant. It's produced, or it's expressed through body, speech, and mind, and it comes from greed, hate, and delusion.
What's the significance of beginningless?
And beginningless means, like, this whole process didn't just start in the multiple lifetime model, it didn't just start when we were born in this life. It's like this has been rolling on this way since beginningless time. Cause and effect, karmic cause and effect, through infinite time and space, beginninglessly. Just widening the picture that it's not just like, oh, you know, all the karma I created yesterday. from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. Like, this is like, oh, I feel like I didn't do anything so bad yesterday, but like from beginningless time, I don't even know what this, you know, stream of cause and effect consciousness has produced beginninglessly. It's kind of just, but we're still saying, I avow it, or I confess it, or I repent of all the, everything harmful I've done that I don't even know about, whether in this life or other lives. That's the spirit, I think, of that Zen verse that we do. Like, completely open to everything that's been done and all the results that are coming from that. It's a total opening to what is, through that verse, based on karma.
Jean-Paul Sartre wrote a book called No Exit.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha might disagree with that. You seem to be moving toward an exit, cessation of karma. But this business, the beginning of this, might be entitled No Entrance.
No entrance, yeah.
No entrance.
And the, you know, samsara, this, which is the cycle of birth and death, fueled by karma. That'll be a definition of what we call samsara. Is beginningless, and for most beings, it's endless, or it looks endless. But then the Buddha's like saying, in the middle of this beginningless stream of cause and effect, of painful cause and effect, because there's this self-view running through it all that's just feels constricted in the midst of everything to some extent, that there is an end, which is kind of radical, saying, you know, for eons this has rolled on this way, and in this lifetime there can be an end to this painful stream. So, yeah, there's an exit. And how that plays out, you know, again, mostly presenting here from the point of view of this early tradition, where, and some of these things about cessation of karma and cessation of suffering, and which are completely related and go together, and like an arhat is this realized one in the early tradition that's like no longer reborn, which was looked like that this is the goal in the early teachings. In the Mahayana, we have a little shift, but the classic Mahayana view is still has this rebirth view, but it's like we vow actually to keep being reborn. This is the classic Mahayana view, to keep being reborn into this cycle of suffering just to help people there. So it's still it's like the opposite goal, right? Instead of like cutting it off. And how these two go together, because they sound like opposite goals in a way, I think they're not so different. Because the bodhisattva path is more like, we're coming back, but we're coming back, and if you want to say it, just in this life even, we're being born, reborn, and dying constantly through this life every moment, but we're vowing to continue in this cycle in a more and more free way, because that's how we're going to help people, but without cutting it off. The early teachings is kind of like we're cutting off this whole cycle. You know, and again, it's very complex to talk about this and what exactly is being meant. And my feeling is that it's just a different emphasis. It's not completely opposite, really. It's just the emphasis on, in the early teachings, is like this aversion to this life cycle is actually kind of problematic because that creates karma. So if we're just completely open, not grasping it or averting from life and death, then we can freely go through all of it.
So we have karma, which is immediate. We have karma.
You mean the action, the intentional action?
Yeah. Well, the
and the results.
We have immediate consequences.
The results and the
And then we
intentions.
Have consequence, which is sometimes later.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of like direct consequence.
Yeah.
Huh?
Mm-hmm.
And then even beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
So Mahayana seems to add a kind of a notion, perhaps, of indirect. We put a ripple out there, and it makes its own thing, and it comes back indirectly. And so we really can't get off the karmic wheel until all the indirect stuff is also. So we are saying, not only right at this second, not only in the course of my lifetime,
mm-hmm.
all of the indirect as well,
yeah.
I'm going to avow.
Yeah, like air pollution.
Yeah, so if you really take into account the impermanence and the interconnectedness, you really say, you know what? I can't miss this moment because it's one of the moments, And this is where it is so vast it has to be this way.
Yeah. So I think as we hear these teachings, and some of them might not make sense either, but I think going over this whole overview, painting a picture from all these different angles, and some of if the details don't make sense, I think it's okay. We'll just keep trying to paint the picture more and more fully. And in the end, I hope that this is what I felt from my study, just getting into this very both kind of sobering and inspiring sense that, like, yeah, this very moment, every moment of our life is like completely important, in the sense that, like, we're actually creating, we have an intention every moment, and everything we do has an effect. And so it's just like, it's a meditation in itself to open to this more and more, that that's everything matters, basically. Everything we do matters, and is creating our whole life, and not just within ourselves, is creating how, and we see that, we can see this ourselves throughout the day. Our intentions are creating different effects later in the day, better and worse, or, you know, happier and unhappier. And also the whole world is being affected. So the more we open to how karma works, the more awesome it seems to me that our responsibility and it by studying intention, it shifts our own intention, I feel, to be more and more in line with happiness and freedom. Just by seeing how it works more and more clearly, it naturally evolves in this positive direction, which is, I think, hopefully the greatest benefit of this discussion today. Is this even a small way that we can just, like, watch how this works more and more carefully, so that we see, oh, actually, we have this incredible power, you could even say. Karma, our intention, is this, like, infinite power to, like, create the world as we want it. And it's kind of scary a little bit, too, that we have such power.
So you could say the idea of studying the self is studying intention, is studying our sense of possibility in the future as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So I feel that it brings possibility in the way of not me directly or indirectly influencing the future, but by taking care of this study now, by seeing how I'm operating, it can direct courses in the future.
Yeah, it will. Yeah, inevitably, it's already happening. Everything we're doing is directing, is shifting the future. And the more conscious we are about it, the more conscious we can create the future that's most beneficial. And of course, and the more we see, and also I think the more we study it, the more we see our mistakes. You know, or the more we see, the more we have to avow our twisted karma, and I think it's very humbling just to study this too. Like, wow, and like, I can see how doing this or even not doing this affects this and doesn't affect this, and so it's evolving in this, I think, messy way too. Karma, I think, is really a messy situation, in the sense that it's like we can't figure it out, or we'll go crazy. Exactly how it works, and we have all our karmic intentions are actually conditioned by all our past karmic intentions. Like, this moment of our being is a result of all the past. So it's not like we can suddenly say, "Oh, from now on, I will only do good." It's like we can't just say that, because we're karmically conditioned from the past. That's why it's almost like an evolution. We're evolving, and I think the main way to steer or influence the evolution towards a more positive direction and towards complete freedom in the end is by just watching it more and more carefully. Not even intending to shifted necessarily, but that I think the main intention in the, you know, study of karma is to just like close awareness of how it's working. And by understanding these teachings more and more, that helps us too.
I don't know if it's a question or a comment. In our Western culture, we have this strong sense of free will.
Yeah.
And in my early studies of Buddhism, Catherine would say, "You don't have free will. Mm. This is not a concept that exists in Buddhism."
Yeah.
And then if it doesn't exist, then how do you have accountability?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have free will, and you do things, and you're still responsible for them, even though you don't have control over whether you do them or not. So
yeah, I think that's a good way that you put it there. You're still responsible for all the actions we do, and there's karmic effects of all the actions we do, even though ultimately, in the end, at the closer examination, it looks like we don't have free will, and the karmic way of saying that why we don't would be because our intentions are conditioned by, and they're based on all kind of past karma. So, and that there's no independent self. You know, free will, I think of as usually like, well, everything's, you know, all these conditions are happening around me, but there's like, or at least I can respond freely in the midst of this. But then we look carefully, well, who is this I that can respond? And the I, when we look more very carefully, it's actually just a bunch of other conditions. It's just a conditioned, it's five skandhas conditioned by past karma. And so, which is also kind of awesome that like we find ourselves in this moment, every moment, that's just this, you know, unique time, place, here and now, this being that we ended up here due to all, in this particular manifestation, continuously changing due to like infinite conditions, a lot of which, some people might say all of which, are karmic, past karma from previous, what we might call me, previous versions of me.
So I always need to ground information in kind of real life activities. Mm-hmm. So I'm asked in our culture to vote every couple of years. And there's a sense that I have a free will to vote for whoever or not ever I want. And or I can vote or not vote.
Mm-hmm.
And there has to be some solidification of myself in order to vote. I mean, it doesn't, if I'm thinking in terms of the five skandhas, then I can't vote.
Hmm.
I have to somehow solidify and say, okay, I'm going to go with the Republicans, or I'm going to go with the Democrats, and I'm hedging my bet that this is the best way to go. And then I go back into the five skandhas. So there's this flow. You know, I'm going to pretend like I have free will and vote.
Well, still, it's like, what we do as sentient beings, we carry this, the proposal is that we carry this innate view of this independent self. Even after we've heard the teachings that there isn't one, we still act from that place, you know, until certain stages of the path. And even at later stages of the path, when it's really clear that there isn't that, you know, internal controller of the five skandhas, still the karmic patterning is conditioned from beginningless time to live in such a way as if there was one, that the illusion would continue to manifest for a very, very long time. And so so for something like voting like this, you could meditate on as you go into the voting booth or something, and you're doing this or that, that actually you can see how as you decide to, you know, press this button or something, it's that is completely conditioned by everything. And you can say it seems so spontaneous in the moment, but actually the proposal with the karma thing, I think, is that every action is just, you know, the culmination of a bunch of conditions. And so voting is a good example, because you can see how our choices to vote for this person or this person are conditioned by what we hear from other people, what we read in the news, what the, you know, the phone calls we get from them, all that stuff. Since they understand cause and effect, the politicians do a lot of like advertising and campaigning, which is, you could say, from this way of talking, it's like that they're trying to create the conditions for us to vote for them, because they know there's actually no free will. It's all just conditioning in some sense. And so let's condition the people to vote for me.
Reach that stone to block.
Yes. Yeah. So I think, you know, in the end, even if we, it's interesting, I think, to be meditating on this just five skandhas without me doing stuff. And you can see, but it really feels like there's me. And then to notice how, you know, what is that actually? And to see how, oh, it's just part of the, generally we could say the fourth skandha. In the early teachings, this is another little divergence, but in the Pali Canon, when the Buddha is first defining the five skandhas, he calls the fourth one, he defines it as chetana, just like karma. So the fourth, you know, these skandhas that are like form, like physical form, body, feelings, perceptions or conceptions. We often say formations, but sometimes karmic formations and consciousness. So this fourth one of like karmic formations was sometimes defined as the main thing that's in it is intention. And then later it was expanded to include all these other mental factors that don't fit into the other four. But you could say the main thing in the main mental quality in the fourth aggregate, the fourth skandha, is intention. So when you're like, I'm going to choose this candidate, you could say, oh, that's the fourth skandha, just the conditioned fourth skandha just chose that. And then the form skandha picked up a pen and checked the box. I mean, you could examine like every intentional activity in terms of these five skandhas that could work without a self. Just, you know, the five skandhas are all this churning, evolving mass of dependent co-arising as it's a particular living being subset of the dependent co-arising universe in the stream. And this kind of talk is how we can talk about rebirth when we get into that. It's just this evolving stream in the midst of the whole dependent co-arising. And this evolving stream has its own kind of lineage of, you know, like, I don't suddenly become you the next moment. Like this five skandhas just ceased, and another, based on that cessation, another five skandhas arose, and we don't even see the arising and cessation. It's every moment. And it looks continuous, like, I still look like me, and you still look like you. And that's why there's these, you could say, these different streams of dependent co-arising that we call individual people, and so on. And so it's not just like at death, one stream is going to merge with all the other streams. I mean, it might be this way, but this traditional way is like that stream continues to evolve. But now the body is not one of the things. But let's come back to the rebirth thing. A little bit.
Yeah, this is not rebirth. This has more to do with something that Kathy mentioned. In AA, in the world of AA, which is very pragmatic in a sense, very real world, there's something in the big book called The Promises.
Mm-hmm.
And two of them are, we won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. That's one of them.
Mm.
Another one's kind of a companion piece of that, no matter how far down we've fallen, we'll learn how our experience can benefit others.
Mm.
Okay. These promises arise as a result of a practice of suspending willfulness. The will comes in.
Well, you could say it that way.
That's what the AA say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think more accurately you could surrender your will to a higher power or something.
God's will, not mine.
But that takes a will, that takes an intention to do that, right?
Well, relaxing willfulness, it entails will, associated with will or free will, is this object thing.
Mm.
You know, that being willing is different from willing, from having a will. So imposing my free will is different than just being willing. Willing is like an objectless opening to possibilities, whereas will is more like, I'm going to do this for that.
Mm-hmm.
If we actually pursue those promises, we can't get them.
Mm-hmm. I can see that, and I would say from the way the Buddha is teaching, I would understand it that that they would both be called Chetana, but that the first one would be like a grosser form with a more reified self view, Chetana,
yes.
In intention, and the other would be like it would be a more subtle and a kind of like the intention to let go, but it's still, especially if we talk about intention as just the pattern of the mind, it's the, you know, it's the intention to not carry the self forward in the same strong way, but it's still, the mind is a certain shape to allow letting go. So I think even in Zazen, or dropping off body and mind, we could talk of as it's still an intention, a very subtle intention there that's not like a big, strong, effortful me doing something, but it's more the mind is just shaped or directed towards non-doing.
Yeah.
And at some point, there might be the realm where there's not the action done by the independent self. But I think it's interesting that there's these five universals in Abhidharma and the Buddha's teaching of every mental moment, and I think they would include like deep samadhi states and so on, and one of them is Chetana. So I think it's a very refined, subtle kind of intention that's more like the pattern of the mind that can easily turn into a grosser form of like, I'm going to do this now.
So a heavily defiled Chetana would be this, I'm going to do this in order for that.
Yeah.
Defiles. As we kind of purify the defilements, we get down to this more airy space in which there's not actually control.
Yeah, I think we could say that, but it's still Chetana. And so we're like, all this you could say is like training Chetana, training intention to be more and more like less and less that the gross I kind of, you know, plowing through the world and kind of knocking everything out of our way and towards this more wholesome karma. And that's still what the Buddha is going to talk about too. So the origination of actions or conditions for actions are greed, hate, and delusion. And then this is about the cause and effect part. Any action performed with greed, born of greed, caused by greed, originating from greed, wherever one's selfhood turns up, so that's one translation, and I don't think it has the actual word self, but it's talking about it. Another translation says, wherever one is reborn, and that could even be in this life, wherever there's a new moment of birth, of a moment, there that action will ripen. So it's kind of like we do some action, and then there's another moment of birth, either the next moment or a long distant moment, that action born of greed will ripen. Where that action ripens, there one will experience its fruit, either in these three times, in this life, the next life, or subsequent life. And then same with hate and delusion. And then this, just as when seeds are not broken, not rotten, not damaged by wind and heat, capable of sprouting, well buried, planted in well prepared soil, and rained upon, those seeds would thus come to growth, increase, and abundance. In the same way, any action performed with greed, hate, or delusion, born from them, wherever one manifests, we could say, there that action will ripen, because the seeds of karma, it's talking about, which is a common metaphor the Buddha uses, doing an action that like plants a seed, and then these seeds are not damaged, means they're like, nothing's destroying, unless it's the cessation of karma, they just keep lying there in the ground of mind, you could say, and then the rain is like further conditions will rain on that seed, and they'll sprout at some point, due to all these other conditions, like, right, we don't control the rain. There's all these other conditions, like, we have karmic seeds of anger, for example, and then the rain will be like, somebody provokes us, and then, like, I have this habit of responding in this angry way, so boom, the seed sprouts, and the result of the anger that was lying dormant suddenly, you know, comes to fruition. So these are three causes for origination of action. So there's another further three causes now, besides greed, hate, and delusion. These three further causes. Which three? Non-greed, non-hate, and non-delusion. And that's how the Buddha defines them in the negative, but commentaries say they're actually, it's the same. You see, non-greed is generosity, or giving, dana. Non-hate is loving-kindness, or metta. And then non-delusion is wisdom, or prajna, panya. So these are also causes of action. These are the positive ones. And any action performed with non-greed, born of non-greed, and so on, when the greed is gone, that action is thus abandoned, its root is destroyed like an uprooted palm tree, deprived of the conditions of development not destined for future arising. So this is about the cessation of karma. So it's through, when you say non-greed, non-hate, non-delusion, sounds like in that negative way it's like non-doing or something. But I find it interesting where the commentaries agree that actually through these positive actions of generosity, loving-kindness, and wisdom, that actually undoes karmic fruition, so that it's like, instead of being like, you know, these seeds that are in the ground that will ripen, I mean, maybe you could say there are positive, you know, you plant a generous seed and then that also creates conditions for arising, but this is emphasizing the undoing it. It's like pulling out the roots of karma through positive action. And I would understand this to be like to do this completely, generous loving kindness and wisdom, particularly the wisdom part, informs the full selfless generosity and selfless loving kindness, that at that point I think the selfless aspect of wisdom is the key thing that would actually no longer continue this process. It's more like that's when it's just going on as dependent co-arising without the self as the doer, and where there aren't, the results are no longer coming to fruition in the same way. In the end, there's no more resultant. There's just like, there's action, but it's no longer producing these karmic effects. And this is a kind of weird way of talking, but this would be like in early Buddhism, this would be this arhat path. It's like, in the end, the arhat in this life, that they've used, their, all their karmic effects have come to fruition. So all their, you know, the negative karmic effects, they've experienced the pain that they needed to in this life from negative karma. And now they're not producing any new karma, is often how it's talked about. They're still living in the world, they look like a person, but they're they're not, it's no longer planting these seeds, because it's not them doing it. It's like there's just spontaneous happening, dependent on conditions. And then, as the story goes, at death, that arhat is not reborn again, because there's no resultant to produce a new birth. Whereas for everyone else, it's like that's what's going to produce the next moment of birth in this life or in the next life, if there's such a thing. Birth is produced by karmic effects. So if there's no more karmic effects, then that body dies due to conditions or due to the ripening of past karma. The lifespan ends, and then it's the end. Then there's no more rebirth. And that's kind of like, maybe if we don't believe in rebirth, we kind of, yeah, that's how, isn't everybody like an arhat like that? It's just the end. And then there's all the views of whether we like that idea or not. It's kind of scary to not be reborn, and yet we might think it's kind of scary to be reborn. But again, let's save this for the rebirth part. Anyway, let's...
Is there any chance we're all arhats and don't know it?
I don't think so. Because part of the definition of arhat is like there's no more arising of any greed, hate, and delusion. Mm. Yeah. So if we ever experience greed, hate, and delusion, it takes basically everyone out of the picture. Like it's impossible for an arhat. There's lower stages where there still might be no view of an independent self, but greed and hate still arise due to past karma. The fruition is still, and that would be like, you know, in this early model, like a stream enter or something. And it's all these stages completely fit into this picture of karma and rebirth, interestingly. It's like there's the insight into no independent self, but then they still like create somewhat of a mess in the world, greater, hopefully a lot lesser mess than they did before when they were carrying the self forward. But still, they're creating somewhat of a mess due to this past karma ripening. And sometimes it's described my teacher said something like, it's as if, like, for that person, like, they're, like, suddenly, like, you know, maybe hit somebody or something, but then immediately they say, well, that was really weird. That doesn't make any sense. Who did that? There's no, like, self-view that's, like, trying to defend itself or get back at that person to do that, but yet it happens. And feelings around the sense of a self can still arise, but it's almost like described as like for that stream enter, it would be like, but it doesn't really make sense. It's like almost like curiosity, maybe. It'd be like, that's weird. Or it might be more like, if they're on this path, if they're on that particular path of practice, it's more like, that's weird, and it's like, it doesn't make sense, so like, let's work with these karmic patterns. But based on, instead of just like, I should be a better person, based on a sense of me, it's a natural evolution. That's why they say this path of stream entry is irreversible. It's like, you no longer can grasp the sense of the independent me in the same way. You can never, like, forget that exactly, but you still need a lot of training in the sense of aligning karma with this new vision of no me.
Well, it's a little bit startling and scary, the idea of activity, that repetitive activity that is unconscious. That's more alarming than well, you know, I have this habit of cutting people off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's sort of like that's correctable, but you know, there's activity that just brings up the whole idea of karmic activity that I don't see.
And we might not even see that we cut people off. You know, so I think it's more and more subtle forms of karmic activity, and it would seem that through meditation and through, you know, evolving along this path, that we'd see more and more clearly the subtleties. And somewhere I've heard it talked about it gets along this path, it gets more and more painful to experience smaller and smaller karmic fruitions. So what we didn't even notice cutting someone off before, now we just have the slightest thought of like, oh, that's just like a little annoying, and that's like a stab in the heart just to even have this like little feeling, because the whole shape of the mind is more settled, and the karmic stream is going such a wholesome way that when a little thing happens, it's a big problem. It feels like a big problem.
Well, only a subconscious thing. I recall it was 12 years of my life when I was so confident of my good intentions. I was completely unaware of what harm I was producing.
Hmm.
Completely unaware. And it wasn't until the world collapsed entirely when I got, oh my God, this is the thing. That was weird. You know, so it was that whole different thing. So I think I think we can get become trapped, I did certainly, in this conceit of my good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say this, compared to other times in my life when I was a naval officer actually going out to destroy people, places, things, and situations, intentionally, I thought that was better. Mm-hmm. What I realized is that, yes, I had since become more generous. Yes, I had become more involved with loving kindness, building instead, you know, producing good effects instead of bad effects. And yes, I was wiser in the sense that I could see things as they were better, rather mm-hmm. than put on it what I wanted
mm-hmm.
in the name of God, country, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was corrupt. It was still corrupted. So I had a long way to go, and I had to have a huge crash to recognize that corruption.
Mm-hmm.
It had to just physically not work. The world had to report to me, this is really fucked up. Oh, I guess so. So there's that unconscious thing where...
Well, you're very lucky that you got, you know,
the
worst feedback,
things that ever
right?
happened to me were the best things that ever happened to me. Honest to God. I mean, really, that's an appropriate phrase. So when we talk about non-greed, non-hate, non-delusion, we almost can't talk about generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom.
Mm.
We have to let those ripen too. Because as soon as, at least for me, as soon as I thought I was being generous and wise,
yeah, that's why I actually like the way the Buddha put this in the negative.
Yeah.
I think, and often for those similar reasons, you often hear a lot of this, you know, instead of saying generous, say non-greed, because, I'm being generous in this way, but you people get out of my way or something. So to just call it non-greed is more like, it's a good checking point to see, like, you know, that is generous, non-greed, and yet, it's a little stricter definition, maybe. And I think this point about the unconscious too, unconscious karma, I'm thinking of Zazen, you know, if you're in the realm of talking about karma and so on, that Zazen practice, just if we call that just being really present with our experience in a moment-to-moment way, you could call that a meditation on karma, or you could actually intentionally, karmically, treat Zazen at some period of practice, or if you wanted to, in this way where you're just being completely present, but you're looking particularly at the intention of the mind at all those moments of mind. Mm-hmm. And then I think that's how we discover things, right? the so-called unconscious intentions and karma is through being really aware in the present.
D.T. Suzuki used to define Zazen as making the unconscious conscious.
Mm, yeah.
And to and he also defined it in terms of being responsible for our actions.
Mm.
Sort of curious.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Being responsible, yeah. And I'm going to skip some of these sutras because we're just not going to get to all of them. But there's some, this principle on the bottom of page 3 that you just bring up now, about responsibility, that part, this, you know, a certain Brahmin discourse. So, this is a pretty short one. A certain Brahmin went to the Blessed One, and so on. So then he asks, what now, Master Gotama, is the one who acts the same one who experiences the result of the act? So this gets into this question of responsibility when there's no self, right? It's like, if I do this action, and then tomorrow you're arresting me, but I say, that wasn't me. You know, that was yesterday's person, yesterday's 5 skandhas, I'm not responsible. So he's kind of, you know, asking about this. That would be one way to look at it. Is one who acts the same one who experiences the results of the act? And the Buddha says, to say the one who acts is the same one who experiences is one extreme. To say that is the same person as yesterday, that's one extreme view. And then the Brahman asks, then is the one who acts someone other than the one who experiences? And as you might guess, the Buddha is going to say the one who acts is someone other than the one who experiences is the second extreme. this completely different person than yesterday is the other extreme. Avoiding both these extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dharma by means of the middle, which is a common thing he says. And I think these sections like this are, Nagarjuna, for example, really picked up on the middle way teachings, free from these two extremes. And in fact, in his fundamental verses, he has a chapter on karma, which I didn't include here, but this is basically the way he talks about it, is the doer and the fruition, or karma and its fruit, I think is the name of Nagarjuna's chapter. And are they, the same or different? Or the actor and the one who that fruition comes back to. If they're the same, that implies that there's a continuous self, which the Buddha denies. So they can't be the same. But if they're completely different, then there's no responsibility, and that was somebody else yesterday. So, and then the Buddha says, I teach you by the middle, and then he goes into the standard 12-fold chain of dependent co-arising explanation. From ignorance as a condition come karmic formations, and so on. But you could say, that was his way of talking about dependent co-arising, you could just say, the doer and the one who reaps the fruits are they dependently arise. They're not the same or separate. They're not identical or separate. Those are two extremes. The middle way is dependent co-arising, which is that the today's one who's getting arrested for yesterday's crime depends on the person yesterday who did the crime. Or these five skandhas getting arrested, particularly the form skandha is going to get put in a form jail. And we're going to have feelings about that when we get into the jail. That those five skandhas depend on very complete and real way. They depend on the five skandhas from one moment ago, and those depend on the skandhas from 2 moments ago, and those depend on the skandhas from yesterday, and those depend on the five skandhas from last life. So this is, again, you can start to see how rebirth is going to fit in here as dependent co-arising. There's, without any self carrying through, there's just, this depends on the previous moment, and the previous moment ceases, and that's a condition for the arising of this moment. And particularly we're talking about a moment of consciousness or of body and mind experience. The five skandhas is a technical way of saying this body mind experience.
So if we go to the Heart Sutra for a second, as mm-hmm. a way of reducing the discourse about five skandhas, mm-hmm. and we say at one extreme there is form, the other extreme there is emptiness, mm-hmm. and yet the Heart Sutra says in emptiness there is form, in form there is emptiness. What seems to be saying there is that the experience is actually a constant transformation, that the form is always morphing and changing, and that is our present moment. There is no form that we are, and there is no ethereal essence that we are. It's in our willingness or acceptance of constant transformation of self.
Or we could say form is short for the dependently arisen form of this moment. Mm-hmm. And we've been studying the Genjo Koan in Santa Cruz, and there's that part about each thing abiding in its, we say, phenomenal expression, but it's a translation of Dharma position. Each thing abiding in its Dharma position, which is the particular way that something is dependently co-arising in this moment due to all the conditions everywhere. So you could say form is is emptiness is like this particular Dharma position of form, this particular way that the whole universe is creating this particular time and place of what we call form, or as the sutra goes on to say, feelings, perceptions, and so on. That dependently arisen form is empty or emptiness because there's nothing there but a bunch of conditions. Mm-hmm. So, to say it's not so... I mean, and that's what it is, like this actual physical form. It's not so much that this form the cup that we're looking at is emptiness. It's more like the cup that we're looking at is just all these conditions coming together through our own, our own visual perception of it and the feel of it and all the, the name cup that someone came up with at some point to define this thing. All those things are conditions for the arising of this experience. And that, therefore, it's empty of any substantial inherent existence. So it's like, it's abiding in its dharma position. In a unique, or people there didn't like the word unique, because unique, I guess, implies independent somehow. Or separate. Unique means separate. So particular, I think, is a good word. Or again, merging of difference and unity. This cup is different from that cushion, but it's just a dependently arising experience that's continuously changing, and it seems like we can grasp, get a hold of it, but actually we're not. So let's stop for a break, and then maybe a little bit more on karma when we come back, and then we can get into this rebirth.
Yeah, don't let rebirth
slip by.
No,
yeah.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the bugaboo. We gotta get a rebirth.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Let's take say it's 11:37. Can we just make it 45?
Yeah. There's tea. There's
11:45. Let's try to come back.
There's bathrooms. There's cell phones.